Gandang, son of Mzilikatsi and Duna of 2000, come forward. The hail from beyond the thorn barrier was unexpected and startlingly loud. But it came the moment before Gandang reached the limit of his patience and loosed his eager warriors. Gandang moved forward to the gateway, his plumes nodding about his head, his tread dignified, his carriage proud, so that no men might guess at his uncertainty. At the gateway he paused, and though his expression did not alter nor his gaze waver, he experienced a profound relief that his own wisdom and the words of his little dove had stayed his blade. Before him stood a figure of almost incredible beauty. It took him many seconds to recognize the ragged individual of a few minutes previously. The figure wore cloth of that same peculiarly rich shade of red of the bushrike's chest, brighter than the colour of freshly spilled blood. Though there was enough to stop a man's breath, it was not all. Bright metal ornaments on breast and shoulders sparkled in the morning sunlight. The belt buckle was of the same metal. The belt and cross straps were of the same blinding whiteness as an egret's wing. The tall shako swept down to an elegant point between the eyes, and the helmet badge blazed like a sunrise upon the man's forehead. There was no doubt now in Gandang's mind that here was indeed an important man, and a soldier of repute, as Juba had warned him, and he made a silent resolution to listen to her words in future with even greater attention. He felt a little shiver of dismay at the thought that he might have followed his first instincts and had this man cut down as though he was a worthless mashona, a mere eater of dirt. The magnificent figure took one step towards him and lifted a hand to the peak of that beautiful helmet in a formal gesture that Gandang answered instinctively with a sweeping salute of his stabbing spear. "I, Bakela, request that my token be conveyed to your father, the honoured and victorious Mzilikatsi, and that he be informed that I request from him the right of the road," said the man in his atrocious Cinderbelly, and Gundam accepted the token from his hand, the small package with strange signs and marks upon it, bound up with strips of coloured cloth so beautiful that they would have delighted the heart of even the most vain and spoiled woman. "It shall be done," he agreed. In the moments of his confrontation with Gandang, Zuga had been thinking as furiously as the Matabili, and making his own calculations of survival. Now that he had fallen in with the border impi, he knew he must put aside any thought of escaping southwards. Apart from the fact that they were completely surrounded and heavily outnumbered, he knew that no unmounted man could run ahead of these warriors. They were like machines, built for the pursuit and the annihilation of an enemy. The meeting had not taken him completely unprepared. There had been many a night in the preceding weeks when he had woken in the darkest hours, and he had lain on the hard earth and dreaded a moment such as this. He had mentally rehearsed his actions, from the concealment of any fear, while he won time to don his dress uniform, to the demand to be taken to the king's kraal. When it had gone, as he planned it, when the tall Induna had agreed, "It shall be done," it had taken another enormous extension of Zuga's will not to show relief. He had stood aloof, disinterested, while Gandang had picked and called out five of his swiftest runners and had recited a long message that they must memorize and take to Mzilikatsi. It began with a long recitation of the king's praises, which began, "Great black elephant who shakes the earth with his tread," went on to list the deeds that Gandang had performed since leaving the great kraal at Tabas in Dunas, the march eastwards, the battle at the pass and the slaying of Bopa, the slave master right up to this day's encounter with the white man. After a flowery description of the man's magnificent finery, which Gandang knew would intrigue his father, it ended with a repetition of Bakela's request to be given the road to Tabas in Dunas. The chosen messengers each in turn repeated the long message, and though he showed no change of expression, Zuga was amazed that each of them had it word perfect. It was an impressive demonstration of the developed memory of people who do not have the art of writing and reading. Gandang handed them the sealed parchment envelope that contained Zuga's letter of credentials, and the messengers sprang to their feet from where they had squatted, saluted their Induna, formed file, and trotted away towards the west. Gandang turned back to Zuga. "You will stay encamped here until the king sends word." "When will that be?" Zuga asked, and Gandang answered him sternly. "Whenever the king is pleased to do so." Zuga's little party was left unmolested. Although there were a dozen Matabele Amadoda positioned about the camp, guarding it day and night, not one of them attempted to enter the gateway in the Thorn Scarum. Until the moment when they might slaughter them, the persons and property of their prisoners were inviolate. The main body of the Impi camped a quarter of a mile downstream. Each evening the tall Induna visited Zuga, and they sat for an hour or so across the fire from each other, speaking gravely and seriously. As the days of waiting became weeks, so the two men developed, each for the other, a deep respect, if not actual friendship. They were both warriors, and they had common ground when they spoke of old campaigns and of skirmishes and battles fought. They recognized in each other the strengths, the essential decencies, of men who live by and respect the laws of their society, though those laws might diverge widely. "I account him a gentleman," Zuga wrote in his journal, "one of nature's own," while Gandang, speaking to Juba on the sleeping mat, said merely, "Bakela is a man." Gandang allowed Zuga's bearers to leave the enclosure, to cut and bring in thatch and timber to strengthen and improve the buildings, so that at last Zuga could sleep dry and warm. This, together with the rest and respite from endless marching, brought an immediate improvement in Zuga's health. The deep wound in his cheek healed cleanly, leaving a pink shiny scar. The shoulder mended, the bruising abated, and he no longer needed a staff or a sling for his arm. Within a week, he knew he was well enough to shoot the heavy 4-to-the-pound. One evening he proposed to Gandang that they might hunt together, and the Induna, who by this time was finding the waiting as tedious as Zuga was, agreed with alacrity. Gandang's Amadoda surrounded a herd of Cape buffalo and drove them down in a bellowing, stampeding black wave to where they waited. Zuga saw the tall Induna rise from cover and race in, barefooted, shieldless, and kill a mature bull buffalo with a single thrust of the broad-bladed assegai through the ribs behind the heaving shoulder. Zuga knew that he lacked both the skill and courage to emulate that feat. Gandang watched when Zuga stood to meet the squealing, thunderous charge of an enraged bull elephant, and when the beast went down to the crash of the shot, dropping onto its knees in a storm of dust, Gandang stepped past Zuga and touched the little black hole that punctured the elephant's thick grey hide an inch above the first crease at the top of the trunk. Gandang inspected the smear of blood on the tip of his forefinger and said, "How?" quietly but with force, which is an expression of deep amazement. For Gandang himself owned a musket, a Tower musket manufactured in London in 1837. When he first acquired the weapon, Gandang had fired it at Buffalo, Elephant and Mashona, all of whom had fled headlong but unscathed. Gandang understood that when firing it was necessary to close the eyes and the mouth firmly, to hold the breath, and at the moment of discharge to shout a rebuke to the devil who lived in the gunpowder smoke, otherwise the devil could enter through the eyes or mouth and take possession of the marksman. In order to throw the musket ball to any distance, it was also necessary to pull the trigger with sudden and brutal force, as in hurling a spear. Furthermore, to minimize the recoil of the weapon, the butt should not touch the shoulder, but be held at hand span from it. Despite all these precautions, Gandang had never succeeded in hitting the target at which he aimed, and had long abandoned the weapon to rust away, while he kept his assegai polished brightly. Thus, Gandang appreciated to the full the magnitude of the feat that Zuga performed with such apparent ease. So their mutual respect deepened with each day spent in each other's company, and became almost friendship. Almost, but not quite. There were chasms of culture and training between them that could never be bridged, and always the knowledge that on any day a swift runner might come from the west with a message for Gandang from his father, "Bulala Ambuna." kill the white man. And both of them knew that Gundang would hesitate not an instant longer. Zuga had much time alone in camp, and he spent it planning his audience with the king. The longer he dwelt upon that, the more ambitious became his plans. The memory of the ancient, disused mine shafts returned to plague these idle hours, and at first, merely to amuse himself, and then with truly serious intent, Zuga began to draw up a document, which he headed, "Exclusive concession to mine gold and hunt ivory in the sovereign territory of Matabeleland." He worked on it each evening, polishing and reshaping it in the gibberish that the layman takes for legal jargon, and which he fondly believes would dignify his creation. "Whereas I, Mazilikatsi, ruler of Matabeleland, hereinafter referred to as the party of the first part, etc., etc." Zuga had completed this document to his entire satisfaction when a fatal flaw in his plans became evident. Mazilikatsi could not sign his name. Zuga pondered this for a day, and then the solution occurred to him. Mazilikatsi should by this time have in hand the sealed package. The crimson wax seals must surely impress him, and in his writing case Zuga had two full sticks of sealing wax. Zuga began to design a great seal for King Mazilikatsi. He sketched the design on the back cover of his journal, and the inspiration came from the first of the king's praise names, "Great Black Elephant Who Shakes the Earth." In Zuga's design, the centre of the field depicted a bull elephant, with long tusks raised and ears spread wide. The upper border bore the legend "Mazilikatsi Inkosi Inkulu," and the lower border carried the translation "Mazilikatsi, King of the Matabele." He started experimenting with various materials, clay and wood, but the results did not please him, and the following day he asked Gundang for permission to send a party of his porters under Yan Shirut back to the ancient workings at the Harkness mine to retrieve the ivory buried there. It took 2 days of careful consideration for Gundang to agree, and when he did, he sent 50 of his men to accompany the caravan, with orders to kill them all at the first hint of flight or treachery. Yan Shirut returned with the 4 huge tusks from the 2 bull elephants, and Zuga had not only the material from which to carve the king's great seal, but a gift fitting the king's importance. Ivory was a treasure of which the Matabele had long ago realized the value in trade. It was, however, a scarce commodity, for even the bravest of men cannot kill a bull elephant with a stabbing spear. They had to rely on pickups from animals that had died of natural causes, or the very occasional victim of the pitfall. Gundang's amazement when he saw the span and weight of the 4 tusks decided Zuga. The largest and most pleasingly shaped tusk would be Zuga's gift to Mazilikatsi, if he were ever allowed to reach the great kraal at Tabas Indunas alive. Not only was the threat of the king's wrath still hanging over him, but his supply of quinine powder was reduced to a few ounces. All around the camp steamed the swampy ground, fed each day by the interminable rains, and in the night he could even smell the evil, fever-bearing vapours rising from the stagnant waters to waft over the camp. Yet he was forced to reduce his daily preventative dose of the bitter powder to perilously small quantities in an attempt to eke it out. The inactivity and the dual threat of spear and disease wore on Zuga's nerves, until he found himself toying with suicidal plans to make an attempt to avoid the guarding impi and to escape on foot southwards. He thought of seizing Gundang and holding him as hostage, or using the remaining 50 pounds of black powder to manufacture a combustible with sufficient power to destroy the entire impi host at a blast. Reluctantly, one after another, he recognized these as plans of folly and abandoned them. Gundang's impi came again in the dawn. Zuga was awakened by a stentorian voice calling him out of the thorn scarab. Zuga threw a fur kaross over his shoulders and went out into the grey and icy drizzle of rain sloshing through the red mud to the gate, and he knew at a single glance that the king had at last sent his reply. The ranks of silent Matabele surrounded the camp, still as statues carved from the black wild ebony. Zuga judged how swiftly he could reach the loaded gun beside his cot in the little thatched hut behind him, and guessed that he would probably be cut down before he could fire a single shot. Yet he knew he would still make the attempt.